When I open my door, my mother is standing in my room, the empty bottle of Xanax in one hand and the other hand palm up as if she were questioning someone even before I arrived. "Wait a minute," I say, "just wait." "Oh, I knew it," she says. "I knew there was something wrong."
It's the COI Podcast. Sergey Burbank, Coordinating Director of Conflict of Interest Theater Company. The COI Podcast combines a love of literature with a love of performance, and in this episode, we will have Some Say the World by Susan Parabo, performed by Tatiana Gomberg.
There is fire in my heart. I do what I can. I sleep deep sleep. I sit in my bedroom window, bare feet on the roof, and scratch dry sticks across the slate. In the 2 months I've been living here, though, I spent most of my time playing board games with Mr. Arnett, my mother's new husband. He seems to have an unending supply of them in his basement from when his kids lived at home. My mother isn't around very often. She works at the makeup counter at Neiman Marcus, although she really hasn't needed to since she and Mr. Arnett were married. Mr. Arnett retired a few years ago at 40, when he sold the windshield safety glass company he'd started right out of high school for what my mother described as a fancy sum for something that still shatters. It was right after that that she met and married him. But she works anyway, only now she calls it a hobby. It's early March, more important, Monday night, the night Mother pretends to be in class at community college. This semester it's poetry, but she's run the gamut. 2 summers ago, she thought she had me convinced she'd taken up driving. When she comes in the door a little after 9, she sets her untouched poetry book on the end table next to where I am on the couch. "How was it?" Mr. Arnett asks, smacking his gum and not looking up from the board. "Oh, my," my mother says. "You wouldn't believe the things people wrote then." "Who'd you do tonight?" I ask her. It's a game I have worked up. Sometimes I expect that Mr. Arnett is playing it as well, but other times I think he's just being duped by her. You can never tell with Mr. Arnett. Sometimes I imagine he has a secret life, although he rarely leaves the house. He seems the type of guy who might have boxes of knickknacks buried all over the world for no reason. "What's that?" my mother asks, separating the lashes over one eye, which have been caked with sweat-soaked mascara. "Who'd you do tonight?" I put a cigarette in my mouth, wait for one of them to light it. "Oh, Browning," my mother says. "Which one?" Mr. Arnett asks. He looks up at me, not her, then takes the lighter from his shirt pocket and snaps on the flame in front of my face, so close I could reach out and swallow it. "Which one?" she asks. "Which Browning?" Mr. Arnett says. The lighter disappears back into his shirt. My mother misses a beat and then says, "Oh, all of them." She hovers over the Parcheesi board, feigning interest in the game, and her mink stole knocks one of my pieces to the floor. Mr. Arnett makes a disgusted sigh, although it was he, I know, who bought her the thing. She likes to wear it to work, along with a lot of expensive jewelry. "She does not work for her customers," she recently explained to me. "She works with them." She pats my head. "About your bedtime," she says, as if I'm 12 and have to get up early to catch the school bus, not 18 and drugged beyond understanding anything much more than Parcheesi, and knowing that my mother, at 40, is sneaking around in motel rooms. My parents were divorced when I was 5. I've not seen my father since then, but even so, I've been able to keep track of his moods. If my mother is irritable on Monday nights, I know that my father is considering calling everything off. If she's sad, I know that he's asked for her back. If she's her usual perky self, like tonight, I know things have gone as planned. They have met every Monday in the same motel since I was in the sixth grade and playing with lighters under my covers after bedtime. I used to find motel receipts, not even torn or wadded up, but just lying in the kitchen wastebasket next to orange peels and soggy cigarettes, with Mr. and Mrs., and then my father's name following. Still, my mother, through 8 years and two more husbands, has never spoken of it to me and acts as if I couldn't possibly have figured it out. Thus, over the years, I have been forced to make up my own story of them. Passionate but incompatible. My father, a dashing and successful salesman, only through town once a week, only able, willing, to give my mother 3 hours. Other times I think it's she who insists on being home each Monday by 9. She who likes doling herself out on her terms, only in small doses. I imagine that they do not talk, that their clothes are strewn around the room before there is time to say anything, and back on by the time they catch their breath. It's easier for me to think of it this way because I can't imagine what they might possibly say to each other. At Neiman Marcus, where my mother works, they found me in a dressing room last winter with a can of lighter fluid in my pocket stuffed with old underwear and dish towels. This incident was especially distressing because everyone fondly thought that after nearly 8 years, I had been cured. That the fire was gone. That I was no longer a threat to society. The police led me out of the store handcuffed, first through women's lingerie and then smack past the makeup counter where my mother was halfway pretending not to know me. Or to know me just well enough to be interested in what was taking place. They put me away for almost a year for that one. My third time in the hospital since the first fire. The length of my stay was caused by pure frustration, I'm convinced, on the part of the doctors. The we'll teach her philosophy of psychology. 2 months ago, they let me out again. Into a different world where my mother is married yet again, and I spend my days spitting on dice with her husband and asking politely for matches to light my cigarettes. Either the doctors think I'm cured, or they've given in, the way I have. The way I did, when I was only 11. And I realized that fire is like blood, water, shelter. Essential. The thing about fire is this. It's yours for one glorious moment. You bear it, you raise it. The first time, in the record store downtown, I stood over the bathroom trash can, thinking I would not let it grow, that I would love it only to a point, and then kill it. That is the trick with fire. For that 30 seconds, you have a choice. Spit on it, step on it, douse it with a can of Coke, but wait one moment too long. Get caught up in its beauty, and it's grown beyond your control. And it is that moment that I live for. The relinquishing. The power passes from you to it. The world opens up, and you with it. I cried in the record store when the flames rose above my head, not from fear, but from ecstasy. I sleep 16 hours a day. More if it's rainy. Another rationale? Xanax and I will be too tired to start fires. I'm in bed by 10 and don't get up till nearly noon. Usually I take a nap before dinner. The rest of the time is game time. It's a murky haze, more often than not. Me forgetting which color I am, what the rules are. Sometimes Mr. Arnett corrects me. Other times he lets it go, and it's 3 turns later by the time I realize I have moved my piece the wrong way on a one-way board. We're on a Parcheesi kick now. 7 or 8 games a day. We don't talk much. Mostly we just talk about the game. About the pieces as if they're real people. With spouses and children waiting in a tiny house for them to return from their endless road trips. In a slump, you're due, Mr. Arnett will say to his men. Sometimes he whispers to the dice. This is all to entertain me, because he's always checking my reaction. Usually I smile. 2 times a week, Mr. Arnett drives me across town to see my psychiatrist. He reads magazines in the waiting room while I explain to the doctor that I am fine, except for the fact that I take so much Xanax, I feel my brain has been rewired for a task other than real life. The doctors always smile and nod at this, raising an eyebrow as if I had given him some new information that he will get right on, and then tells me the medication will eventually remedy any discomfort I might be feeling. I'm used to this, and I've learned not to greet with great surprise the fact that no one is going to help me in any way whatsoever. It's Friday, and on the way home from the doctor's, we drive by a Lions Club carnival that is set up in a park near Mr. Arnett's house. It's twilight, and my mother will be waiting for us at home, but for some reason, Mr. Arnett follows the waving arms of a fat clown and pulls into the carnival parking lot. "What do you say?" he says. He takes a piece of gum from his pocket and puts it in his mouth. I look out the window at the carnival. I don't get out much. Grocery stores are monumental at this point. The sight of all these people milling around, the rides, the games, it frightens me. A Ferris wheel directly in front of me is spinning around and around. It makes me dizzy just watching it. "I'm kind of tired," I say. Mr. Arnett chews louder, manipulates the gum into actually sounding frustrated. "I think it'd be good for you," he says. He's never said such a thing before, but instead of causing me to feel loved and comforted, it makes me nauseous. I've been told everything from shock treatments to making lanyards would be good for me, in practically the same tone. I feel like crying, and I know if I do, he'll panic and take me home, but I don't have the time. He's out of the car before I can well up any tears, and I continue to sit, my seatbelt still on, staring out the window into the gray sky. Mr. Arnett stands in front of his fender, gesturing for me to come join him. Last time I was at a carnival was the freshman fair at my high school, 5,000 years ago. I went on a Saturday night with a boy named Dave, who took pictures for the school paper. He held my hand as we walked through the crowds of people, and he was sweaty, greasy almost. Stuck his tongue in my ear in the haunted house ride, and I barely noticed because they had a burning effigy of our school's rival mascot on the wall. When the fire licked along the walls, and I realized with absolute glee that they had set up one hell of a fire hazard. Mr. Arnett gets back into the car with a sigh, but does not drive away. "You need to get out more," he says. And I wonder what's changed. Wonder if he had a fight with my mother, or sex with my mother, or some other unlikely thing. "Used to take the kids here," he says, spinning the keys around his finger. I don't even know his kids' names. They call occasionally, but he speaks so rarely when he's on the phone with them that I can't pick up very much information. I imagine them jabbering away somewhere about work and weather and the press around while he sits on the kitchen stool, picking his fingernails and nodding into the phone. "I'm not exactly a kid," I say. "You don't like carnivals?" "I just don't feel like it." "If she doesn't feel like it, then she doesn't feel like it," he says, as if there's someone else in the car, another part of him, maybe, who he's arguing with. We continue our drive home in silence. When we stop at a red light, he says, "Why do you take all that shit if it makes you feel so bad?" I laugh at him. It is a question so logical that it pegs him for a fool. I can't believe I'm really sitting here with him. "It's not quite that simple," I say. He shrugs, gives it up, continues to drive home. He's not a fighter, not a radical. Once I came upon him in my bedroom, looking through a photo album of people he had never met. I stood in the doorway and watched him for nearly 10 minutes as he smiled slightly, turning the pages, and I imagined him making up lives for the people in my life. He's that way. Content not to get the whole picture. I'm standing in the bathroom, trying to stir up enough nerve just to dump him, the whole bottle. My mother taps lightly on the door. I spend more than 2 minutes in the bathroom and she gets edgy. "Honey?" "Just a second," I say. I'm holding them in my hand. All of them. There must be a million of them at least. Enough to confuse me until I hit menopause. "Are you sick?" I close my hand around the pills and open the door just far enough for her to get her foot in. "Mother," I say, "I'm fine. I'm just putting on a little makeup." This gets her. Physically sends her back a step. She wants to believe it so much that I can see her talking herself into it. "But it's almost time for bed," she says. Just to see how it looks, I say, giving her a smile through the crack and inching the door closed again. I hear Mr. Arnett's heavy footsteps come tromping up the stairs. What's the fuss? He asks. She is putting on makeup, my mother says in a stage whisper. Maybe she's trying to look cute for you. That takes care of my clenched hand. It opens of its own accord at my mother's words, and the pills sink to the bottom of the toilet, falling to pieces as they go. I think she's really just feeling up to it. Starting to feel better, I hear my mother say. It's a new tone for her. And this time it's really a whisper. Really some sentiment she doesn't want me to hear. I put my ear against the door. I'd do anything to make her happy, she says. Makes my chest hurt. She believes it so much. Sunday has come, and my eyes can't stay open wide enough. I feel as if I had gotten glasses and a hearing aid over the weekend. Colors are brighter and words sharper, no echoes. Words stop when mouths stop. My mother looks at me suspiciously when she comes into the kitchen early in the morning and finds me cooking bacon. What has gotten into you? She asks, pleasantly enough, but with a flicker of panic on her face. Me around the oven means bad news for her. But the heat rising from the burners is only making me warm, and the smell of bacon is so good I can't think of much else. Just feeling awake, I say. She smiles, nods, and then studies me. I am fine, I tell her. Mr. Arnett drags into the kitchen, his hair mussed and his robe worn. I've never seen him in the morning. Well, look who is up, he says. He winks at me. Why don't I finish up and you two go in and start a game? My mother says brightly. Mr. Arnett sits down at the table and opens the newspaper. I don't feel like it, I say. Why don't we do something today? Oh, we have to go to a party later, my mother says, glancing at Mr. Arnett for support. Oh, I don't think you had very much fun there. I set a plate of eggs and bacon in front of Mr. Arnett. Where's mine? My mother asks. You hate eggs, I say. We don't have to go to the party, Mr. Arnett says. My mother frowns, looks from him to me. Well, I do, she says, and I think it would be right for you to come with me. She can take care of herself. I see my mother now. Like she's been stripped down out of her clothes and her skin and even her bones. Her soul is steamed over and dripping fat droplets. You'll go on, I say. I don't mind. I spend the day with my father. I sit out on the porch with the old photo album. The pictures make sense now, fit into an order I never seen before. My father is a young man, raises a tennis racket over his head. He's swinging at something, but a butterfly or a bug, not a ball. In another, he stares away into the distance while my mother pulls his arm, trying to get him to look at the camera. But they are so clear now. My father and his bird nose. In one picture, he holds me on his lap. I'm crying, screaming. My father is looking at me, perplexed. He's barely 20, I know, and cannot believe that I am his. My mother and Mr. Arnett do not come home till late. I've lost track of time, still sitting with the photo album, when the headlights swim into the driveway. They get out of the car, and my mother takes Mr. Arnett's hand, swings it wildly around. Oh, darling, my mother exclaims. I'm not sure if it's to me or Mr. Arnett. They are both drunk. My mother stumbles, going through the door, and Mr. Arnett catches her, leads her inside. Then he comes back out, grunts, and sits down on the porch steps. What have you been doing all night? He asks. Looking through this, I say, holding up the album. He's quiet for a moment. Then he says, you ever see your father? He says it almost as an afterthought, but to something that wasn't said. He says it like we've been on the porch together all night, discussing my father for hours, like he was really one of the family. Just in here, I say. Think he's still a good-looking guy? dashing, I imagine, I say. He snorts out a laugh. Why'd you marry her? I hear myself ask. He leans back, rests his head on the wood inches from my feet. Company, he says. He yawns, and I can see him now, too. Safety glass that still shatters. He begins to snore. Mr. Arnett, I say. I reach down and just barely touch the top of his head. He doesn't move. I go into the house and up the stairs. Their bedroom door is closed, and I imagine my mother is in about the same shape as he is, but they'll sleep it off in different places with dreams of different people's arms. When I open my door, my mother is standing in my room, the empty bottle of Xanax in one hand and the other hand palm up as if she were questioning someone even before I arrived. Wait a minute, I say. Just wait. Oh, I knew it, she says. I knew there was something wrong. Nothing's wrong, I say. What are you doing in my room? You scared me standing there like that. Her mouth opens. I scared you? I don't think I need these anymore, I say. Forgive me if I find it difficult to trust your judgment, she says. Oh, I want a cigarette bad. I had to go all night without them, and I go to the dresser for my pack. A light, I say. Do you have a light? Oh, not on your life, she says. I'm fine, I say. I accidentally break the cigarette between my fingers and reach for another one. She sits down on the bed. You hurt people, she says, quietly. Not just me. You think you take those pills because I don't want you to hurt me? I never hurt anybody, I say. You are so lucky, she says. You could have killed both of us 5 times over. In the dressing room, did you ever think about the woman in the next one? I wasn't trying to hurt anybody, I say. You don't understand. Oh, you are right about that, she says. She sets the empty bottle on the bed and stands up. I am sorry, she says. I can only live with this for so long. She leaves. I hear her bedroom door close. The house is silent. Below me, Mr. Arnett sleeps on the porch. I sit down on the bed. I am crazy, all right. I have always been crazy. I see my mother standing on the front porch as I get out of my first police car, only 14 braces, squeezing my teeth. She stares at me in disbelief when the police tell her that I have caused over $1,000 in damage at the record store. $1,000 with only one match. It's then that she begins to look at me like a stranger. Monday again, and she is in her bedroom preparing. Mr. Arnett sits in the rocking chair watching a basketball game. I'm on the couch. Cheers from the crowd. She wants you to go back into the hospital, he says. He doesn't look at me. He moves his glasses from hand to hand. I know, I say. It's okay, it's not so bad there. Anybody play Parcheesi? A man on the court has lost his contact lens. Players are on their knees hunting. Cards, mostly, I say. Lots of jigsaw puzzles. He nods. You take those drugs today? No, I say. Soon enough. It's funny, being able to see so well, but not great so much. My mother comes into the room and picks up her purse. Have a good game, she says. She kisses Mr. Arnett on the top of the head, presses her lips into his hair for a long time until he moves away. What was that for? He asks. He really wants to know, I can tell. It doesn't have to be for anything, does it? She says. She smiles at me, lingers for a moment as if she has something to add, but cannot remember what it could have been, and then she leaves. Mr. Arnett swings the rocking chair around and faces me. You don't have to go, he says. Imagine me here all by myself. You'll do okay, I say. Come visit. He nods, picks up the poetry book from the coffee table where mother has left it, absently flips through it. She didn't even think to take this along, he says. She doesn't try so hard anymore, I say. To fool anybody? He stops on a page, squints at it, puts on his glasses. Here's one you'd like, he says, smiling. Some say the world will end in fire. Others say in ice. He stops, looks up at me, and raises his eyebrows. I'd like to see them, I say. I hear my mother's car start up in the driveway. Just one time. See them together. Be a fly on the wall. We can be flies together, he says. It's not a long drive. Only a few miles. Much too close, as far as I'm concerned, for something that seems like it must be another world. Mr. Arnett stays a few cars behind her, then drives past the motel after she pulls into the lot. He drives around the block twice, then three times. What are you waiting for? I ask him. A reason not to do this? He says. He presses down the accelerator and we speed past the motel again. We drive around the city looking at closed down stores, empty streets. We don't talk. Act as if we really have nowhere to go. He finally makes his way back to the motel. And this time, he pulls into the lot. We park at the far end and walk along the row of empty spaces towards my mother's car. The motel is nearly empty, but the room next to her car is occupied. The shade on the window is up a couple of inches, and Mr. Arnett squats down, then reaches for me. I close one eye and look inside. Bathroom light is on. The door is open, and I can see my mother gingerly applying her eyeshadow in front of the mirror. There's a man on the bed, sitting up, yawning. He stretches his skinny arms. He's nearly bald, but has a small mustache under his pointed nose. It's a stranger. No one I have ever seen before. He looks a lot different from the pictures, Mr. Arnett whispers. It's not him, I say. But as soon as I say this, I know that it is. Mr. Arnett looks at me. Sweetheart, he says. My mother shuts off the bathroom light. I can see her silhouette move to the edge of the bed. She sits down and touches the man on the chest, running her finger from his throat to his waist. He takes her hand and puts the finger in his mouth. It's like watching shadows. She says something I cannot make out. Is it about me? Of course, I realize it is not. I shiver in the cold. Mr. Arnett takes off his sweater and sets it round my shoulders. The man begins to put his clothes on, slowly. Next to me, I hear Mr. Arnett's breath catch. What is it? I whisper. I wonder if he can be jealous, if he cares that much. He only shakes his head. Chilling, he whispers. What? I say. What happens to people? They're sitting on the edge of the bed together. My mother fumbles for her purse, takes out a pack of cigarettes, gives one to my father, and takes one for herself. She lights them both. Where will we go? Mr. Arnett whispers. What? I say. They're holding hands in the bed. The shadow of the smoke drifts above them, the tiny circles of fire that light the room. Where will we go? He says. I lean against him. He is warm. Inside the room is quiet. Together, the man and the woman raise the cigarettes to their mouths. For a moment, the faces of my parents glow in the darkness. Then Mr. Arnett takes me by the arm and actually lifts me off the ground. Wait, I say, wait! But I don't fight him. I want him to take me away, finally. I have seen enough. We are three blocks from the motel before he remembers to turn on his headlights. Slow down, I say. You're going to kill us both. I take out a cigarette and push in the car lighter. Jesus Christ, he says. What would she do then? For a moment, he is insane. So much more than I could ever hope to be. There are lights up ahead. Music. It's the carnival. It's last night in full swing. The car wildly spits up gravel as Mr. Arnett rumbles across the lot. He jumps out of the car, dashes forward a few feet, then turns and slams his fist into the hood. Then he is perfectly still. He looks straight at me, and I'm afraid to move. The cigarette lighter clicks out. A father rushes his children into the back of the station wagon next to us, where they look at us through the big back window, mouths open. I pull the lighter out, touch my fingers close enough to the middle to feel the raw heat. Then I light my cigarette and blow smoke into the windshield. Mr. Arnett watches me. I know now that he will never go back to my mother. Will probably never lay eyes on her again. Something about seeing them. Even though he knew, something about seeing them. He turns and starts walking toward the ticket booth. I get out of the car and follow him, stand behind him smoking while he buys two tickets. Ferris wheel, he says, turning to me. He smiles slightly. None of those puke rides. Slow rides tonight. We get into a car that I'm sure is broken. It swings differently from the others, crooked somehow. I start to say something, but a girl with yellow teeth and matching hair closes the bar over us as we're suddenly moving in a great lurch forward. "Hey, hey," Mr. Arnett says, squeezing the bar and looking down onto the park. "These things are dangerous," I say. "Bullshit," he says. "We're safer up here than anywhere else in the world." We screech to a halt near the top. For the loading of passengers into the cars below us, we swing crookedly over the game booths, and I can see us crashing down into the middle of the ring toss. Ugh, so many ways to buy it, so few to stay alive. "I've always liked the looks of Canada," Mr. Arnett says. He's smiling pleasantly, innocent as the dawn. We start moving again. The motion is hypnotizing. I no longer feel sick, but only strange, detached. "Nice night for driving," I hear myself say. He doesn't answer. He's looking at my hands, which are open, palms up on my lap, as if I'm waiting for something on this ride. He reaches into his sweater pocket and takes out his pack of gum, sets it in my hand. My fingers close around it. We swing around again. Below me, I see a circle of teenagers standing around a small bonfire, warming their hands. Sparks pop around them and die in the grass as the flames reach higher. The Ferris wheel whips us toward it, and then away again, up into the night.
The COI Podcast is made possible through the generosity of donors to Conflict of Interest Theater Company and is available streaming on the web at conflicttheater.podomatic.com. You can also find us by searching for The COI Podcast in the iTunes podcast directory. Graphic design is by Eunice Inquimboy. Legal advice, Paul Renitz. Special thanks to Gamze Ceylon, Anne Galloway, Jennifer Rathbone, Eileen Trilly, Jason Updike, and Sam Van Holmgren. Questions, comments, and submissions can be sent to conflictinfo@gmail.com.